So I wanted to start today by telling you a story about an experience I had a few years ago. Does anyone recognize what this picture is of, by chance? Okay, I see some nods. So it's a Japanese onsen or a hot spring. Okay, so that'll come into the story. Yes, so I was on a short-term mission trip in Japan. This was a year or two before I had met Shirley, and I was struggling really hard with the implications of pursuing a career of doing missions in Japan, like by myself, doing it alone and like unmarried without a family, things like that. In my social circles at the time, it had been proving basically impossible to find someone else who was just a committed Christian, like let alone someone who was interested in being involved in vocational ministry, let alone someone who would even consider overseas missions as part of their life, let alone go to Japan in particular. The idea of family and children had been extremely important to me for basically as long as I can remember. And yes, like certainly in missionary circles in particular, some others can be quick to point out possible downsides to family and kids in light of doing ministry, referring to passages like 1 Corinthians 7, this is 32 through 33, it says, this is Paul talking, an unmarried man is concerned about the Lord's affairs, how he can please the Lord, but a married man is concerned about the affairs of this world, how he can please his wife, and yes, things like that, so how, yeah, it can be a benefit to be single and committed to ministry. But on the other hand, Genesis 2:18 is also pretty clear when God says, it is not good for the man to be alone. I will make a helper suitable for him. As partners in fulfilling God's mandate to be God's representatives here on earth, certainly there are fundamentally good things about having a Christ-centered family. That's what I was struggling with at the time. So it was a summer night, and I was sitting alone in a hot spring, as one does in Japan. But even if I was calm on the outside, inside I was just railing against God's treatment of me in my heart. I was thinking things like, you know, God, if you're supposedly so good, how can you subject me to this kind of ongoing suffering? Why would you call me and draw me to a path that, at least so far, has been a huge barrier to meeting someone and fulfilling this huge felt need that I have? Other Christians may say things like, you know, don't make relationships an idol, and you know, find your fulfillment in Jesus, and you know, be content in God's unconditional love for you, and you know, sacrifice and suffering is expected when following Jesus. You know, I know these things, I agree with them, but despite years of grappling with those ideas, this wound in my heart is still there. And if I'm honest with myself, I don't think I'm strong enough to endure it forever. Is a family really always a hindrance to ministry? Can't it be good to have a partner? How can you claim to be good and loving while just leaving this void in my life, neither satisfying that need nor taking the want for it away? I was struggling really hard. And this certainly hasn't happened often in my life, but that day, I felt like I got a clear answer back. I had this mental image of Jesus just like hanging out in the hot spring with me, which is a bit of an odd image if I'm honest. And he replied to me, "This suffering is worth it. And you can trust that it's worth it because as you're suffering with this, so am I." Like I'm suffering on your behalf because you're suffering. So like a parent who cries for their child as they send them off on their first day of school because they know from their own time at school the challenges that lie ahead, and yet with a hug and a kiss they send them on their way. Because so too from their own time at school they know that it's worth it. Like, I am doing this for you. I would not ask you to shoulder a burden I do not carry myself. And though this thought wasn't really what I wanted to hear, I did feel peace and reassurance in it, and it helped me keep going. So take this as you will, if this is divinely inspired or like just my imagination, but I believe the truth behind it is real, right? The incarnation matters. Jesus knowing what it's like to be a human matters, right? Jesus becoming a human has so many implications for humankind, you know, not just for our eternity, but for our day-to-day lives as well. Now, I do believe in, say, like, the divine impassibility of God, if you use theological terms, where in the Lord's infinite power and in his constant and unchanging nature, I believe that God can't be lessened or wounded by suffering, and as such, he can't be said to suffer in the same way that humans do, even if he can certainly know suffering through his divine knowledge, right? But we need only look to Jesus permanently taking on human nature alongside his divine nature for us to know with absolute certainty that Jesus profoundly knows, currently experiences, and deeply empathizes with the human condition. It is under that context that he calls us to follow after him as his disciples and to honor him as king. As we continue with this season of Advent, you know, we not only remember Jesus' first coming and its significance as we quickly approach Christmas, but we also look ahead to Jesus' second coming, where even though Christ's work is finished and assured, it is still unfolding into this world and will come completely one day. So in the past few weeks, we've been looking at traditional Christmas hymns and exploring their theological foundations. And today we'll be looking at O Holy Night, particularly focusing on the second verse, and then its connections to our Bible reading for today in Matthew 2. Just a little background before we listen to O Holy Night. It was originally written in 1847 by, this is a French name, so forgive my pronunciation, Placide Capot, as a poem to be read for the Christmas midnight mass for his church in France. Within days, Capot worked with a famous opera composer named Adolphe Adam, and it quickly grew in popularity among the masses, among the people, right? And interestingly, among the clergy, it was criticized for its progressive lyrics concerning equality and the abolition of slavery, leading to many churches in France banning its usage. In 1855, the song made its way to America, where John Sullivan Dwight is credited with writing the most widespread English translation that you're most likely to hear today. As it is, there aren't actually many contemporary recordings that I could find, at least, that include the second verse. They pretty much always go from the first verse to the third verse. I found one. Hopefully, it's good enough for our purposes today. So, yeah, let's have a listen to that.
Oh, holy night, the stars are brightly shining. It is the night of the dear Savior's birth. Long lay the world in sin and error pining, till he appeared and the soul felt its worth. A thrill of hope, the weary soul rejoices, for yonder breaks a new and glorious morn. Was born. Oh, night, oh, holy night, oh, night divine. Led by the light of faith serenely beaming, with glowing hearts, by his cradle we stand. So led by light of a star sweetly gleaming, here came the wise men from the Orient land. The King of Kings lay in him bend. Truly he taught us to love one another. His law is love, and his gospel is peace. Chains shall he break, for the slave is our brother, and in his name all oppression shall cease. Sweet hymns of joy in grateful chorus rise we, let all within us praise his holy name. Christ is the Lord, then ever, ever praise we his power and glory, evermore proclaim his power.
Yeah, don't get me wrong, the first and third verse are definitely like very good, but it is a bit of a shame that the second verse is often missed. The King of Kings lay thus in lowly manger, in all our trials born to be our friend. He knows our need, to our weakness he is no stranger. Behold your King, before him lowly bend. Who is Jesus really? Do we recognize him for who he really is? And as such, do we respond to who he is appropriately? With these questions in mind, let's start looking at our reading for today in Matthew 2, so starting in verse 1 and 2. After Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea in the days of King Herod, wise men from the east arrived in Jerusalem saying, "Where is he who has been born King of the Jews? For we saw his star at its rising and have come to worship him." Before this, in chapter 1, Matthew provides a genealogy spanning from Abraham all the way through to Jesus. And then after this genealogy, he describes the visiting of an angel to Joseph, Jesus' father, explaining how he should continue his marriage to Mary because Jesus was conceived by the Holy Spirit. And like, that's okay, it's part of God's plan. And that he will be Emmanuel, you know, God with us. We talked about that last week. And that he will save people from their sin. Chapter 2 starts with this surprisingly matter-of-fact statement of Jesus' birth in Bethlehem. And then sometime after this, prominent wise men from the east arrive in Jerusalem asking after the birth of the King of the Jews. And then this is a challenge to Herod's legitimacy as king, like we saw in the kids' talk today. As we get into this, I don't want to pull any punches with you. As we approach this passage, understanding the whole Christmas narrative is surprisingly tricky. And really, to be honest, I struggle with it every year as I try and prepare Christmas sermons. Yes, historians and theologians have been wrestling with reconciling the account of Jesus' birth in Matthew with the account of Jesus' birth in Luke for centuries. And it's proven to be no easy feat. So yes, while we generally try, you know, not to get into the weeds about these sorts of things during sermons and either bore you or overwhelm you with potentially distracting facts, I also don't want you to ever be surprised and like struggle with this as well. You know, if that's in your own reading of the Christmas story or maybe watching a video online explaining it or maybe being challenged by your non-Christian classmate, whatever it may be, again, don't be surprised. There is no simple and straightforward way to harmonize Luke 1 and 2 with Matthew 1 and 2, right? Just some examples so you know. Matthew makes it sound like Mary and Joseph had already been living in Bethlehem instead of traveling there from Nazareth, like it says in Luke. Matthew doesn't corroborate the other miraculous events surrounding Jesus' birth, and then Luke doesn't corroborate the coming of the wise men, so neither of them have examples of these things in the other gospel. The beginning of Matthew and the beginning of Luke seem to be off by a few years based on historical records about the rulers that they mention. So Matthew mentions Herod the Great, and Luke mentions this governor, Quirinius. So Herod died sometime between 4 BC and 1 BC, and then Quirinius was governor in Syria around 6 AD. And then he has this like famous census that happens at the time, as it mentions in Luke. While it's certainly in keeping with Herod's crazy character, and there are definitely other accounts of him ordering the deaths of like rivals and defectors, there are no outside accounts of Herod ordering a widespread infanticide like we see later in Matthew 2, like Pharaoh does in Exodus, even though people at the time were probably very interested in documenting just how crazy Herod was. Luke makes it sound like Mary and Joseph and Jesus go straight back to Galilee after presenting Jesus at the temple after his birth, and they don't mention this flight to Egypt to avoid Herod. And then Matthew makes it sound like they hadn't been to Galilee before, as they return from Egypt and go to Galilee, avoiding Herod's son. I want to assure you in all of these things that even if there aren't straightforward ways of reconciling these two accounts, you know, things that are like easy to compare, there are still plausible explanations that can fit. So just a few quick examples of that. Joseph could be from Bethlehem, and then he's only in Nazareth temporarily, and then is required to go back to Bethlehem for this registration, and then he brings Mary along for the engagement. They could have tried to settle in Bethlehem after Jesus' birth, but then they were displaced back to Galilee as they flee from Herod. That's a possibility. A man named Quintilius was governor of Syria during this part of Herod's reign. And there is a possibility that Quirinius co-served with Quintilius at the same time due to particular circumstances. Or there could have simply just been a scribal error when copying Luke, confusing Quintilius with Quirinius because Quirinius had the more well-known census, but then Quintilius had some other type of registration at the time. And perhaps Herod's infanticide, it wasn't widespread. And then Matthew is using the parallels with Exodus to say something about who Jesus is. But then Herod's infanticide was only focused on those who might pose a direct threat to the throne, being a particular concern for Mary and Joseph due to their lineage with David, and Jesus being David's descendant. So maybe not big enough to make the history books, but important for Jesus' story. So these are all possibilities, right? At any rate, like, what does this mean? Does this mean that these accounts are untrue? Like, certainly Jesus' birth in Bethlehem, it was very important to Jewish people being able to accept Jesus as the Messiah. We can read in John 7, John 7, 41 through 43, people are questioning, how can the Messiah come from Galilee? Does not Scripture say that the Messiah will come from David's descendants and from Bethlehem, the town where David lived? And then later in John 8, 14, Jesus has this cheeky response to those arguments where he basically says, like, you have no idea where I came from. You're focusing on the wrong things. So he could mean, like, focus on the fact that I come from heaven, or he could mean, I actually come from Bethlehem, and you have no idea about my background. With this, it doesn't make sense for Matthew or Luke to just invent a birth in Bethlehem, because the people who would have most needed to be reassured by Jesus' physical birth in Bethlehem would have also been the most critical of Matthew and Luke's accounts of it, right? If they were incorrect and easily refutable with facts within living memory of when these books were written, then the accounts would have done way more harm than good, right? Like people of the day, they would have known when Herod lived, they would have known who was governor when, they would have known how Roman censuses work, right? So these things argue in favor of these accounts being accurate, even if they don't seem straightforward to us today, even if they don't make easy sense, right? But all of this to say, right, especially as we go through this account with Herod and the wise men, it does us good to remember that the authors of the Gospels, they sometimes prioritized the telling of theological truth over the telling of historical truth, right? Matthew in particular, as he ties in a number of events to the fulfillment of prophecy, some of these events aren't recorded in the other Gospels when we'd expect them to be, suggesting that he's emphasizing the underlying theological truth of the event instead of the historicity of the event, right? Even if we might struggle with the historical accuracy of the Christmas story, we can be confident in its truth on a more fundamental reality than even physical reality, right? The divine reality of who Jesus is. Okay, so with that long prelude, in our passage, Jesus has been born in Bethlehem, and wise men from the east come to Jerusalem to pay homage to the King of the Jews, because they interpreted the appearance of a star to signify the birth of this king. And they seem to mean King of the Jews in a way that hadn't been seen in Israel for the past 500 years, right, since Israel's exile in Babylon. So when they say King of the Jews, they mean a true king, right, from the line of David. And like there were other kings and the Maccabean revolt and all of these sorts of things. And like Herod considered himself King of the Jews, but he wasn't born Jewish himself. He converted to Judaism, and he was only appointed as king, you know, by Roman appointment, right? I think these wise men's interest in who the true King of the Jews may be, it sheds on light, a light on who these mysterious figures might have been. Who are these wise men? I approach this story often as like, what is this even about? Who are these mysterious guys who just show up, they seem somewhat anonymous, they show up, they honor Jesus, they leave. Like, what's the point? What's the point of this story, you know, other than, wow, important people seem to be honoring who Jesus is, right? So yes, thinking about that, you know, there was certainly widespread knowledge throughout the ancient Near East that there were tensions between the people of Israel and the Herodian dynasty and then Rome overall. And then other countries were likely concerned about things like geopolitical stability, and they might have sent representatives if